And good morning. It is 9 a.m. You are tuned to KBBI and KDLL 91.9 FM Kenai Isil Dotna and AM 890 KBBI Homer. It is time once again for the coffee table on this Wednesday morning. I'm your host, Shaylin Cochran. And of course, we've got our intrepid production team down in Homer helping us out. Terry Renzel and Shady Grove Oliver helping us out in Homer. And this morning on coffee table, we are going to be continuing a conversation that we started way back last year, and we've had a couple of installments of this lecture, this discussion, this talk over the last several months. And this morning we are joined by Dr. Alan Boris, anthropology professor at Kenai Peninsula College. Dr. Boris, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Well, thank you, Shaylin. It's nice to be here for another installment of Kenai Peninsula History 101.
That's exactly what we're talking about. And as I said, we've had just a great time hearing this lecture, sort of a series over the last several months. Again, as I mentioned, this is the third installment, and in the first couple of chapters, we examined and learned a little bit about the very early history, the very earliest peoples of the Kenai Peninsula, sort of their ways of life, the way they made life happen here, and then we moved forward, and in the last installment, I believe we talked about the arrival of the Russians and the ways that that impacted the culture, and in some aspects, the landscape, and changed things here on the Kenai Peninsula, and of course we still see lingering effects from that period of time. But now we're moving on into sort of the next phase of growth and development, if you will, on the Kenai Peninsula, and that is the appearance and the arrival of commercial fishing canneries. And this is like a really, really big deal in the history of the Kenai Peninsula.
Alaska has sort of branded itself in terms of history as the Gold Rush and the Gold Rush era. In fact, we have a license plate that shows intrepid miners climbing up to go to the gold fields, and that certainly was important, but essentially the gold miners came and mined for a while and they left, and left Fairbanks and Nome, but as far as really a transformational agent of history, it was the salmon canneries. The canneries along the coast from Bristol Bay around down to southeast that really were the major impact during the late 1800s and the 1900s and still today. So gold came and left. Well, there's still a few mines around, but salmon canning and now freezing is that sustainable resource that is still around.
And that sustainability, I have to imagine, is one of the biggest reasons why the canneries came to be. Are there other parts of that kind of a commercial operation that sort of lend itself to this area? Obviously, we have so many salmon, but was it just because it was such a wild, undeveloped area? It was sort of ripe for the picking, like so many other things at the time?
So the canning process was invented in Europe. And it was, of course, applied to many things, vegetables. But as far as fish, it quickly jumped to the Grand Banks of Newfoundland. And this is in the mid-1800s, mid to late 1800s. And then to the Columbia River. So it solved the problem, particularly with salmon, of how to process this massive amount of food resource, a highly nutritious food resource, in a relatively short amount of time and keep it so it could be distributed. And that took a lot of capital. So once it jumped to Oregon and the Columbia River and West Coast, it then quickly jumped to Alaska. And the first salmon cannery was, I believe, near Heidelberg in 1880 or 1881, and the second cannery was actually in Cook Inlet at the mouth of the Kusiloff River in 1882. And it took a lot of capital, so that capital came mostly from railroad money. The railroad barons who had made millions and maybe more in building the railroads in the West had that capital. So they came north, and they, without buying land or doing anything, they just plopped their canneries down. Lumber from the Douglas firs from the West Coast, and the retorts and the canning operation, and brought labor. Most of the labor coming in the form of the Chinese cannery workers, who many had previously worked on the railroad. So they went from driving ties and all of that, blasting, to working in the gut line of the cannery. And they came, and that canning operation boomed.
I'm really curious, you know, when you think about a major industry moving into an area, a lot of times we can point just simply to the Taps line here in Alaska, and you can point to that sort of time in history and see the sort of cultural impacts of an industry like that coming in and all those jobs and all those people. Are there similar sort of impacts or effects from the appearance of these canneries? I have to imagine there would be on the native populations, the folks who were already here before these canneries went up. What kind of impacts culturally did these canneries have?
Well, it was significant for the Dena'ina. And of course, once the canneries spread, you know, Cook Inlet, then into Bristol Bay, throughout southeast Alaska. So one dimension or another of this occurred in other places as well. But since we're here in Cook Inlet, and I know that best, we'll talk about that with the Dena'ina. And the key sort of concept is debt peonage. And this is the process where, in this case, local Dena'ina were given easy credit at the company store, which was run by the cannery or by the Alaska Commercial Company. The Alaska Commercial Company formed from the old Russian America fur trade companies and the Russian America Company. Initially, it was bought by the Hutchinson Coal and Company and then transformed into the Alaska Commercial Company, which, by the way, was the first chain store in the United States. So the chain stores we have here in Kenai and in Homer and throughout Alaska are nothing new. The Alaska Commercial Company was that first chain store. Although, you know, so if they didn't have it, you didn't need it.
Yeah, who knew that we were this mecca for retail marketing?
Retail mecca. So either through the Alaska Commercial Company store in Kenai, there's one in Kisilov, there was one across the bay near Seldovia, and other places. Over in near the Chuitna River, near Tyonik, there was another one. So for desired goods, rifles, ammunition, cloth, credit was given to local indigenous Dena'ina. And what that meant is because they had previously not been in a cash economy but had been in a clan-based system that fished and processed fish for the clan use, for the clan, for the village, their labor now had to go to the cannery in order to pay off that debt. So these records are all, they're still there in the Alaska Commercial Company records, and you can see who got debt, and some paid it off, and some weren't able to pay it off. But even if you paid it off, so you work a summer for the cannery, that takes you out of the old clan-based fishing system. Then you have to borrow to get through the winter, and now you have a debt to pay off again, and so you have to work for the cannery again in the summer, and so it goes. And this is not unlike many places where there was a company store, the old Tennessee Ernie Ford song,
right?
16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. Same thing with the coal mines that song alludes to, and not unlike what the Visa, MasterCard process is today. I have a debt peonage card in my pocket.
Some people call it fun tickets, yeah, debt peonage, whatever.
Yeah. So the point probably there is that the Dena'ina were no fools. They knew what they were doing. You know, we buy houses, we buy cars, we buy it on time. Oh, you know, can I afford this debt or can't I? But you need the items, and it does affect our life. Debt drives the economy today. Debt is the basis of modern value. It's not the gold standard anymore. It's what's our money worth in terms of debt. So this goes way back. And so the Dena'ina, what the upshoot of it was for the Dena'ina was the old clan-based village system rather quickly disappeared and shifted to individual Dena'ina families working in a number of areas, trapping or working for the cannery, and that really changed the society immensely.
I'm really interested, in sort of the genesis of this cycle that you're talking about, because when you think about it on the surface, you, at least to me, it's all right. There's this native population here. They've really got it dialed in. They know what they're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
They've got it figured out here. This other thing comes in. What compels them to be involved in that system? Why is it a system that they sort of, I don't want to say can't get away from, but why does it become such an integrated part of their culture and then end up sort of to some degree replacing their culture?
Well, I wish I had an answer for that. That's a hard question.
That's a career's worth of work, right?
Yeah, but it's a good question. And so how do we get into these situations? You know, how do we do it? And I would say it starts out simply. A man who's a hunter and has used a bow and arrow and sees a gun and sees the advantage of a gun will want to get that gun and because of its advantages, or a trap or whatever it might be. And there's a mechanism to do that. And so he weighs the options and does it. You don't think in terms of social transformation when you're committing individual acts that are in your favor or perhaps not in your favor, but the cumulative individual acts are what transforms society. We don't see it happening. I mean, it's happening now. We're in the midst of a revolution with the internet. So I want a computer. And how's that changed my life? And I'm on Facebook. And how's that changed my life? And how's that changed my daily operation? And I don't think of the big picture. I don't think of the whole social transformation process and political transformation process. We're in a political season now, and a lot of it's coming through the internet, through Facebook, and through other types of things. And I guarantee you 100 years from now, people will look back at this time and say, well, this was the start of this radical change. Same thing back then. I think it was individual acts that sort of triggered change. And at some point, people said, whoa, I guess we can't go back to where we were.
That's so interesting that that an industry comes in and really expands. And as we're talking about cannery, just expands what made the native populations, the Dena'ina culture that was here, what made them successful, expands that for commercial purposes. And you can look all over the place and see other examples of that. And it's so interesting that you have, to me anyway, that you have this culture of people who are so, again, so good at this, and this is what they do. Yeah. And all of a sudden now they're put to work just a massive expansion of what, you know, drying and preserving fish.
Yeah, yeah. It's everywhere. If I may, I grew up on a grain farm in northern Minnesota, and my dad was a grain farmer, and he was part of that whole process of more of greater intensification of grain. And we had a neighbor, Ed, and Ed was an old Finn, and he was not going to buy fertilizer. Manure from his cattle was just fine. He was not going to modernize. He was not going to go to single monocrops. And he stayed with the old ways. He even burned with wood in that area, well into whenever. Finally bought a car, I think. And we looked, as kids, we kind of, you know, it was a gentler age. We would never have made fun of him to his face, but we kind of joked about him. And but I look back at it now, and Ed had it right. Ed had it right. Ed lived a sustainable lifestyle in control of his own destiny. And I think if we look back, we learn much from the Dena'ina. They had a sustainable lifestyle in control of their own destiny, because what you give up with debt peonage is you give up control. And that's part of the industrial age. So when the canneries came in, I don't know, but I don't think it was insidious on the part of any one cannery operator. Oh, we'll change the people. They needed labor. And if they're going to go and go into debt, well, that's their problem. So it was that rugged age of early non-corporate capitalism, in the sense of owners from West Coast, primarily San Francisco, later Seattle, who built these canneries here in Cook Inlet.
Again, tune to the coffee table this morning here on KDLL and KBBI. We're speaking with Dr. Alan Boris. He's an anthropology professor at Kenai Peninsula College, and we're continuing this discussion that we've had over the last many, many months in a few different parts about the history of the Kenai Peninsula, the cultural changes that have occurred over many hundreds, if not thousands, of years here on the peninsula, and getting into the impacts of canneries. This is one of those sort of linchpin moments in history where an industry comes in, and it's really a watershed kind of a moment. Things really, it's such a stark dividing line of sort of before canneries, after canneries. As we talk about this is what I'm, the sort of notion that I'm getting is that it's kind of a before and after this happened, and there's just such a stark difference between those two eras.
Clearly, and this all happened in the late 1800s. As I said, the first cannery comes into Kasiloff. You can still see remnants of it today. We haven't done a very good job preserving our the cannery sites for interpretive history. A second cannery was built in Kasiloff, then one over in the Chuitna River by Tyonek, and then Kenai, and so it went. All of a sudden, it just kind of booms. And now, that isn't to say everything was just hunky-dory for the canneries. They did make a lot of money. But there were obstacles. One of the biggest ones was fires. These were fish oil soaked wood floor, wood plank canneries, and they regularly caught on fire and burned, and there goes your canning season. Prices, World War II affected canning and other things, so this was not just the Industrial Revolution comes to the north, but the product, in this case, canned salmon, gets shipped out to the world. And so we become part of what's called world systems. We're a world ecological system, starting with the canneries, and world system theory applies here.
It's Dr. Boris, when we're talking about this new industry coming in and all the things that are attached with that, and I'm really curious about, I guess, sort of specific changes, and I'll allude to it by way of a place like, say, Kennecott, where you have this massive development of some industry, and all of a sudden a lot of technology and a lot of just newness comes in. One I guess, sort of anecdote that I know a little bit about of is this idea that way back in the 20s, Kasiloff had a phone system. Are there other little things like that that sort of came up with this wave of new folks and new industries and cash money? Because that's something, cash money, a cash economy, one of the things that it does is afford you choices.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden you can choose to order these weird things from Sears and Roebuck that have never come this far north before.
Well, choice is good. But yeah, the cash economy, but there are other layers of what happened, and that is a stratified society. So very early, well, and we're talking now in the early 1900s, Kenai transformed itself to a sort of a three-part society. At the top were the cannery bosses, people like H.M. Weatherby or Gompertz or these guys who may or may not live here year-round. Mostly they did not, although Weatherby at least one year lived here year-round. They came up with the cannery ships in the spring and left again in the fall. But they decided who got jobs, who didn't get jobs, who got fired, who didn't get fired. They adjudicated informally disputes. They were very, very powerful people. Very quickly, law and order came, and the sheriff or the marshal became another part of that higher tier of society. The engineers on the canneries were part of that higher tier. They were educated. They knew how to run the steam system, which was very complicated. You don't want to steam, you don't want to blow it up on you. That can be kind of dangerous.
Easy enough to have enough accidents, as you mentioned before, with oily fish floors and everything else. Yeah.
So these were the higher end. And you could add to that probably the priest. Although, at least in terms of Kenai area, Protestantism doesn't come till quite late. But the Orthodox priest would be at that higher tier. So that's the top tier. The second tier was comprised primarily of fishermen from the West Coast. And when I say fishermen, I mean people who built and operated the traps. We can come back to the traps later. Who built and operated the traps in Cook Inlet. They weren't doing the fishing themselves. There was no gill net fishing till much later. Although very early they did try gill netting, but gill netting under sail in Cook Inlet is not a good deal. If there's any, I don't know if there's an opening today or not, if there's any fishermen out there drifting in Cook Inlet, think about doing it under sail.
With a sail, so right.
This is not going to work. So these were from many places. I counted in the 1900 census, based on nationality, I counted 17 languages that would have been spoken in Kenai.
Wow.
And so it was a very cosmopolitan place. It was not this little, little burg. There was a lot happening, a lot of new ideas, newness that came with all these different perspectives. And most of those were cannery workers. Many came from Scandinavia. Most of those came from a part of Finland that is Swedish-speaking. A few from Norway, but a lot of Swedish-speaking Finns came. And there were a lot of Germans. There were a lot of Italians. There were others from various nationalities, and then Americans who had been nationalized and so on. So they sort of comprised the second tier. Now, most of those came and left. That is, they'd come up with the cannery ship in the spring, and they'd leave again in the fall and didn't make much of a dent. But gradually, a few did stay. And of those, there were sort of two types. There were the There were the Norwegian bachelor farmers, to allude to another public radio. In this case, probably Swedish-speaking Finn bachelor farmers.
Very strong, very blonde, somewhat blonde, pale fellows.
Yeah, men of immense ability, but did not marry in and were essentially loners. They were not community builders. Then there were some who did marry in, and many of the families today, many of the Dena'ina families today have a heritage of men who came. The men married Dena'ina women, and then those two levels become sort of the second tier of society because those men had skills the canneries wanted, and hence better employment. A sort of an offshoot of that were the Chinese cannery workers, who almost never stayed, to my knowledge, never stayed. Later, the Filipino cannery workers did come, and a few did come and stay. But the earlier Chinese cannery workers came and went back. And then the lowest tier in the emerging society of Cook Inlet in the early 1900s were the Dena'ina. And so what an insult to become the lowest tier, social tier in your own homeland. And I don't know what, that feeling or that insult was something that people had to deal with. There were other competing threats, the language extinction process in the schools where Dena'ina children were beaten for speaking their language, related things were an insult. And so the revitalization through the Kenaitse tribe and through other tribes in Cook Inlet is part of dealing with that process.
Again, tuned to the coffee table this morning here on KDLL and KBBI, we're speaking with Dr. Alan Boris about the history of the people of the Kenai Peninsula. Again, this is a continuation of a conversation that we've had in sort of fits and spurts over the last many, many months, and today focusing on the period, we're looking at our watches and realizing, oh my gosh, we're almost halfway through the show. Today focusing on that period in the late 19th century when the fishing canneries begin to arrive, and a lot of the changes that are associated with them. And it would be really easy for me to stay, Alan, in this period and get into it a little bit more. But when we talk about, I'm going to try to move forward. And I guess something that it's becoming interesting to me is how many parts of other sort of developmental processes that you can see other places also happened here, but just little pieces of them. So I'm surprised to learn that there was this huge wave of European immigrants, which we saw in that same period in other places of the world. Not so many of them stayed. Same with Chinese workers coming over. Many of them settled in other areas, and we know that story. Areas like San Francisco, California is where they ended up settling. So we have these bits and pieces that are happening all over the country, but up here, it happens in a completely unique way. But there are still those similar themes of the native cultures sort of being subjugated to some degree and losing their social status or having their social status maybe redefined based on the mores and based on the culture of this wave of immigration.
Yeah, well, let me speak to one aspect of that, which is which has been not talked about in Alaska history, it's a shameful part of our history, and that is the Chinese workers, who primarily were in San Francisco, later Seattle. Many go way back to working on the railroads, and almost none of which were naturalized American citizens. Therefore, they did not have rights. And many were tied to their own clan system or family structure back in China. So they were here to work, and most of the money they made went back to China. So this was run by what's been called the Chinese Mafia, out of initially San Francisco, later Seattle. So the canneries contracted with the Chinese Mafia for a certain number of cannery workers. And this was the labor-intensive part of the cannery. This was the gut line. And so it would be typical to have 50, 60 cannery workers come here to a cannery. They lived in their own barracks. They had their own chef. And they worked the gut line. A man named Kuchin, Harvey Kuchin, has described that gut line as it existed in 1906 here in Cook Inlet, and they were processing, one man would be processing 4 to 6 fish a minute, making, I think it was 6 cuts, and slide it on down the line. That's a horrendous, I mean, I could maybe do one, and then that's it. I'd be done.
You take your own catch home and you spend a nice leisurely afternoon gutting these fish. And
4 to 6 a minute. So this was the intensity. So the traps caught a lot of fish. They were brought into the cannery in a tender, and they had to be processed soon. Had to be run through the gut line and then put in the cans or jars or whatever it was, and then into the retorts. So 4 to 6 fish a minute. It's often been said, you look at archaeology reports and they'll have excavated, although there aren't too many, but they'll have excavated an old cannery site and found under the Chinese barracks opium pipes. And the sort of wink-wink thing is, oh, there must have been a bunch of dope heads and all they were doing was smoking dope and you know, living the easy life. Well, that's not true. Opium is a painkiller. We still use it today, not opium itself, but opiate derivatives are the mainstay of our hospital experience if you have a serious injury or serious pain. I remember hearing Herman Lindgren and Herman Hermansen as boys. As older men, they would tell the story of when they were boys and they were told never go near the Chinese bunkhouse. This would be the Libby Cannery here at the mouth of the Kenai. And of course, as boys, they did. They would go near the... wouldn't you?
Well, sure, you're not supposed to do that, so what's the first thing?
Yeah, exactly. And so as I heard Herman Hermansen tell the story, they would peek in and the Chinese men, the gutline workers, at their lunch break, would be smoking opium, which they bought in the company store, by the way. It was for sale.
Sure.
So this was a way to dull the pain. This was a way to deal with the horrendously long work hours, which sometimes involved 12, 14 hours a day doing that gutline work. For this, they were paid a measly sum. The pay went to the contractor, the Chinese mafia boss, and he paid the workers as he saw fit. So we don't know a lot about what they were paid exactly, but it probably was, I worked it out once, where the workers were getting about $300 a month, which is not a lot by today's standards, but you got to put that into $1,900.
Sure.
So that's, I don't know what that works out to today, but it was not bad.
Not an insignificant amount.
Yeah, right. The Dena'ina got about half that, and the Chinese workers got about half of that. So they were making really a measly amount of money for this terribly hard work. And to top it all off, when they went back to San Francisco, they were often forced to live in housing that was owned by the same cannery, same mafia boss.
And you're juiced into that system, and you just can't get out of it.
So that was the real injustice. And we haven't talked about that. We need to expose injustices so they don't happen again. And that's a black mark in the history of the history of Alaska, in my opinion.
Yeah. Again, speaking with Dr. Alan Boris this morning on the coffee table, discussing the history of the Kenai Peninsula. We're into the mid to late 19th century and trying to move onward a little bit. Not sure how far we'll get, but trying to move on. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. If you have questions or comments, feel free to give us a call. It's a toll-free call for our KDLL listeners, 1-800-979-5224. And for our KBBI listeners on the Southern Peninsula, a local call, 235-7721. And I'm curious, as this is such a sort of an apropos time to be talking about canneries and their impacts, because here at the EDD building on the North Road heading out of Kenai, we don't have to go very far to look out over the inlet and see all those drift boats and see, to some degree, sort of the lasting legacy of this development from 120 plus years ago when this all began to happen. It's still there. And what... have we learned lessons? Have things, just society as a whole, have they changed to alleviate all those problems? I mean, obviously, it's not the jungle anymore. As we were talking about these canneries and the working conditions, my mind went immediately to Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, and it's just squalor, awful conditions, and the company store and all that. But I guess maybe from, not necessarily from an economic standpoint, but from a cultural standpoint, have we been able to take away some lessons, or did we just, as the area developed, it just, there wasn't a need for that, or there wasn't a demand for those sorts of things, it just kind of went away? I guess what I'm getting to is, was there a local revolt where people said, we're not going to do this work anymore, or did the fisheries crash and there wasn't a need for the work anymore?
No, there was no revolt. I would say that's a good question. You ask hard questions here. but I would say during the first half of the 20th century, there was gradual change of the type we're talking about. What really changed this part of Alaska, maybe all of Alaska, was World War II. And the, at least for the Dena'ina and others, and the influx of people that came post-World War II, and of course oil is a significant part of that. But with, that's another subject for another day. In terms of fish, let me frame it this way. I never would have thought in 1970 that there would be a problem with the amount of salmon. And here we are today. The reds seem to be doing fine. The silvers apparently are doing fine. But the king salmon are not. And I think that's been a big wake-up call for people that the type of industrial development, and we can extend that to sport fishing as an industry and other types of fishing as an industry. As I drove across the bridge today coming here, a lot of dip netters out there.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's almost becoming an industry of a type. So we're now seeing the decline of the king salmon. And we have to remind ourselves that Alaska is the last place where wild salmon come in abundance, especially Bristol Bay, but Cook Inlet down into southeastern Alaska, the Nass River and other places. Alaska is that last wild place where wild salmon come. By wild salmon, I mean non-hatchery salmon, non-fish farmed salmon. And it has been approved by the FDA GMO salmon, and it's still waiting final approval. So we are that last place. And now we're seeing chinks in that armor of wild salmon with the demise of the king salmon. So we can't, you know, we have to make good choices, but many of those choices do not involve what we can do right here, meaning they're open ocean issues. I believe that the factory trawler system, not the factory trawlers that are the small trawlers that work out of southeast Alaska, but the factory trawlers that come out of Seattle, are one of the major impacts on the king salmon by their targeting the pollock fishery, and the kings feed on pollock, and there you go. But there's other issues as well. Global warming is clearly an issue, and it's somehow affecting ocean temperatures, and is that going to affect? And we need to understand that process. And another insidious one is ocean acidification. So we've got all these issues coming up that leave us the last stand, so to speak, the last wild salmon. And is it going to go downhill on our watch, or are we going to maintain it?
Yeah, very important question. As we see king salmon return struggle, some folks who are heavily involved in that industry are trying to adapt, trying to find other ways to make a living here without such an intense focus on king salmon, because they simply aren't there. And I'm curious if we can look back to previous times, and I'm thinking right now specifically of around statehood and controversies with fish traps and how the politics of that played out. If struggling king salmon returns force people to adapt, changes in laws and regarding how we can harvest fish force people to adapt, are there other things that we can look at that are sort of clear-cut moments that, all right, this was a point where folks had to make a little bit of a turn and find a new way of doing things? Or has life on the Kenai for folks in the fishing community always been relatively well-to-do?
Well, I wouldn't call it well-to-do, but I would call it stable. Although I'm sure other people have done this too. Based on cannery records, I've charted the catch I haven't broken it down by species, but by salmon catch, and it's sort of if it goes up and down, up and down, up and down, but steadily up, with a few downs. There was a downtime during the Depression and other times, but steadily up. What that tells me is that the style of fishing through fish traps that was employed by the canneries up through statehood did not have a detrimental impact on salmon. That is not true in other places. In Kodiak, for example, and in Southeast, and some places in the Bristol Bay area, in the early days, in the early 1900s, canneries would just block off whole rivers, just block them off, and sometimes take the fish they wanted and leave them blocked off. I mean, it was nuts. Greed, pure out-and-out greed. So traps got a bad name. It was well known to fishery managers in Washington, what few there were, and they sent like two or three a year, that this was a problem, and so that was eventually dealt with. But it was not a problem in Cook Inlet, and that's because of our relatively straight coastline and our immense tides. That same man, Cutchins, that I mentioned, wrote that traps, as far as he knew, were the most sensible form of fishing in Cook Inlet. So the way the traps worked is during the winter, of course, the old trap was wiped out by the tides and the ice and all of that. So they had to be rebuilt every year, and that was the job of the usually Scandinavian fishermen. They'd have a pile driver, and they'd come in and they'd put in new poles and a new heart, it was called. It was the area that the fish were diverted into, and then they'd string it with wire or whatever they had, and the fish came along the coast, and they would be diverted into this heart, and when it was full, they would lift a net and dump it into a tender and put it back down, and this is the important part, when they weren't fishing, they just opened up a gate, and the fish swam on through. Very efficient, very good type of fishing in the sense that it allowed for escapement at the same time as it caught a high quality fish. And then of course it was brought to the cannery, and there goes the work of the Chinese cannery workers. The issue came with the canneries, and these were those old railroad barons, lobbied Congress to register the traps, and the best trap locations were registered to the canneries.
Like a trademark almost?
Like a monopoly, almost.
Right.
So individual Alaskans, as Alaska grew and into territorial days, did not have point access to the salmon. That was controlled by the canneries. So there was no gill net fishery, there was no beach set net fishery, because the canneries had these wickedly efficient traps. The main issue of statehood was access to fish, and that's what played out in much of the actions in Alaska, at any rate, as how can we get access to fish. And it became a very emotional subject. For example, Edna Ferber, a noted author, wrote a novel called Ice Palace, in which she contrasted the evil cannery empire with the rugged individual Alaska fisherman. And you can get the movie, by the way. It's still a pretty good movie. You know?
Holds up?
It's not too bad. You know, you gotta live with it. But that's what. But in the process, traps became vilified,
right?
And they shouldn't have been. They should have been vilified. It was the political ownership of the traps that were the problem, and the registration of the traps to a limited number of people. That was the problem. It wasn't the traps themselves, but sort of like gun laws. You know, it's not the gun, it's the shooter that's the problem. So same thing here. The trap became the target of the statehood movement. And so one of the first acts of statehood was making traps illegal.
And of course, we know that that was the biggest driver behind getting statehood is dealing with these fishing issues and the politics that are involved with it. And I'm wondering, were there other political issues of the day? Because we don't, or at least I don't tend to think of there being, you know, these political battles about fish traps versus non-fish traps. Or is this the point at which we first begin to see sort of politics as we know it on the peninsula?
Well, a lot of this plays out in Juneau and the emerging anchorage. So parallel to this was the politics of oil. So this then became the two sort of issues of statehood. Will Alaska be able to become a state? And who's going to own the fish? And who's going to own the oil? Still the issue today. Fish and oil.
Yeah.
Still the main issue. You know, all the rest, I mean, I'm all for all other industries, but these are the two driving industries to this day.
And there's so much more that I want to get to, but I'm looking at the clock and we only have about 14 or 15 minutes left here. And what I really am, I'm hoping I've given you enough time to kind of address this as we move forward. And we're going to skip some stuff here, but as we get to this point of statehood, what does that do for Native cultures? Or not do for Native cultures?
Yeah. In many parts of Alaska, Native communities felt they were better off as a territory, better off with a single government, better off with a federal government, rather than, I mean, we essentially have a two-tiered system now. You have to, permit-wise, let's say, for example,
sure,
you have to deal with federal permits, you have to deal with state permits, now even borough permits, but it's a two-tiered system. And for, how should I say this, for people who, developers who have an interest in an area, it is easier for them to get through the state system than it is to get through the federal system. So many of the major developments we're talking about today are now pitting the state versus federal oversight. And, you know, you hear state politicians and others talk about federal overreach. Well, I don't know if the federal people talk about state overreach or not, but that's an example of that system. So
right.
I get back to your question. So many Native folks felt that they had a better ear because if it involved a development that they may be dealing with to protect subsistence rights, those who would develop had the ear of the state system. They did not have the ear of the federal system. It's, you know, you can talk about virtually any development today, and it's the same thing now. So many Native folks felt that statehood was not in their best interest.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that there was, though, some sharp divide, because as we've had this conversation, we see cultural changes come onto the Kenai Peninsula, as we see sort of, we could call it economic development come to the Kenai Peninsula. We don't ever see total agreement among the area's Native populations. There are always some who buy into the change and some who don't, and that seems to be one of the things that's pretty consistent throughout history.
Yeah, that's true. And that's the issue that Indigenous people have to deal with. Just like that guy way back when, do I buy this rifle on credit? That takes me out of the traditional system, puts me into the new system. And what are the consequences of it? We have painted the picture in our school setting that we should transform Indigenous people into good, you know, into good
God-fearing
middle-class
Christians
American,
and
all
hard-working
that.
Folk, yeah, all of those sort of cliches.
Mainstream and schooling practices being part of that and all of that. But it's much more complicated because individuals and communities and families, Indigenous people, have to make that decision. It's not, for many, it's not that they are rejecting modern technology. Many parts of modern technology are good. People like their TVs, they like their computers. If they live in an urban area, they need a car and so on. But what Indigenous people have that I think across the board wish to hold on to is a tie to the land, and B, a family, extended family. So that extended family operating under the land, through the land, and that's the dilemma that they face. To become too tied up into modern economic systems separates you from the land of your ancestors, separates you from that act of subsistence that is so vitally important, that is rooted in social organization, and that is rooted in spirituality. Most Native Alaskans don't view the world and the land in terms of a place to be developed. They view it as a spiritual system. And most non-Native folks don't understand that the land is a spiritual system. So to give that up is to give up a major part of yourself, and that's a huge dilemma that you have to deal with.
And when you talk about these different sort of, I guess we'd just say these different sorts of belief systems that don't have to be, but a lot of times are at odds with one another. Looking throughout history, it always seems like the one side prevails, the side that brings jobs and brings the change and changes sort of the way that things work and changes the economy and makes it an economy in a place where before there wasn't an economy, there was just people living. It seems like that's the side that, for lack of a better term, always sort of comes out on top. And
well,
to ask you why that is, I think, is kind of an unanswerable question. But is that
because our modern culture's fundamental spiritual value is materialism? That's what drives us. That's how we judge one another. That's how we judge ourselves, by our material self. And it's even rooted in spirituality now. On the other hand, that's what's killing us. That's what's killing us, because this unmitigated drive to materialism is name any of the problems today, global warming, whatever, it's rooted in this huge materialistic fantasy. We have a lot to learn from Native cultures, a lot to learn. It's not that we reject materialism, but we need to temper it, and we need to understand the spirituality of the land and sustainability in order to keep this world going. Because any way you slice it, we cannot continue on the upward curve, whether it be salmon or oil or other resources or human population. We cannot continue on this upward curve. We have to do something. And that's the problem. It's so immense. How do we do it? But it comes from individual decisions.
Right. As you pointed out earlier, it starts small with the man who decides, all right, I'm going to get that gun instead of using this bow and arrow. I'm wondering, it feels like, at least in my very short time here, that there is some level of, at the very least, recognition for some of that Native culture and some of that Native heritage. And there seems to be a lot of effort going into not just preserving it, but promoting it and getting it back. And you can look at things like recent exhibits from the Anchorage Museum that brought these wonderful artifacts all over the place that that folks had never seen before, that they didn't understand how these systems work, and we learned a lot of new things. And we see the Denaina Wellness Center just went up, and that's a very positive step forward, because that shows that as an organization in this sort of modern world of ours, that they're thriving and they're doing well and they're navigating that world very well. We also see efforts to increase native languages and exposure to native languages. Taking all those things in concert with what I sense on the peninsula as, I don't know if it's always been here or not, but I sense a kind of a push toward being more self-sufficient, being more self-sustaining. Is this an area, based on the time that you've been here, are we kind of trying to turn some sort of a corner to not necessarily revert back to the way things were, but to integrate these systems in a way that makes a little more sense? Is this an effort that you've seen emerge, perhaps, that wasn't here before?
Yeah, well, first of all, in terms of the Denaina, if you were to ask people on the street in 1970, who is the indigenous culture of this area, people would say, well, there isn't any. Or they would say Eskimo, or they would guess something. Now, most people would know it's the Denaina. The Wellness Center, the museum exhibits, the Denaina Center in Anchorage, the major attraction there. So that's changed. And I think the next step along with that is to understand what that perspective is. As I said, it's normally a spiritually based perspective. As far as other changes, there's a lot. I think a lot of people are asking questions of what do we want our children's world to be? How do we, food security, for example. What's the quality of our food, and to what degree can we control it, and can we grow our own, and can we grow some of it? And there's many places in Alaska, native villages, where they have the best diet in the world. They have salmon, they have moose, they grow some potatoes, they have now these cold bin, whatever those things are called, the hothouses. Growing some vegetables, best diet in the world. And they control their food. They control the food resource. And that's ultimately what we want to have happen.
Yeah, that's such a key to being able to live and thrive in an area that's harsh like this. It's hard to you can't just put up a tent and make a go of it. You really need to be able to take advantage of what's there to prepare yourself.
Yep. But it also means an adjustment to the modern workday world. You can't live off the land, you can't do subsistence, you can't be an intensive gardener, and have a full-time 9-to-5 job. Something's got to give. There's some places in rural Alaska where, for example, during salmon harvest, they just shut down the whatever it is. We're going fishing now. We don't need to have this. But that kind of thinking is, that's not going to happen here in Kenai. People have to squeeze it into their free time, whatever that concept is.
Yeah.
So there's a lot that needs to be done, but we're asking the right questions and we're using history to guide us. That's the key.
All right, very good. And that brings us all of a sudden to the end of our hour. Dr. Boris, again, thank you so much for joining us again and continuing this conversation. As we've gotten up to this point of around statehood, World War II, this area, I'm sure there's a little bit further that we can go on this topic.
There's a lot. So no callers? I mean, I thought there was going to be
hard questions here. That's all right. Well, again, thank you, Dr. Boris, for joining us this morning, and thank you all for listening. You have been tuned to The Coffee Table this morning here on KDLL and KBBI. I'm Shaylin Cochran. Have a great morning.